Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Anxiety RX podcast. I am today going to talk about some psychedelics, some moving from a organized career to just throwing it all away and doing something else. I've got Julie Savon with me, and we're going to talk about psychedelic-assisted neuroplasticity, somatic work, and why a lawyer would be afraid of badgers. So, Julie, welcome.
Hi, thank you so much. I'm so excited to be here and honored to have this conversation.
Sure. So what's the badger thing about?
My grandma was a tough as nails lady from South Dakota, and she was not afraid of anything. She lived through the Great Depression and the Dust Bowl. I've seen her pick up tons of snakes and, you know, throw them back into the grass, but she would always say, don't put your hands in badger holes. So I was just like, if my grandma is afraid of a badger, that, I mean, have you seen Honey Badger?
Honey badgers are one of my favorite animals, actually. I love that video on YouTube about the snake. You know, and the snake bites him and he just goes, ah. And then he wakes up and he keeps eating the snake. Like, those are tough animals for sure. But it's funny, you know, because, you know, usually kind of phobic stuff starts when we're around 7 years old. Mm-hmm. So if we have a parent or whatever that's afraid of something, they can easily transfer it onto us. It just that seems to be like between 5 and 7 seems to be prime phobia, you know, in neuroscience. So we sort of see prime phobia sort of time is between 5 and 7. So if kids get afraid of something between 5 and 7, I'll tell you my own story. So one, my father was schizophrenic and bipolar, just to jump in. And so he had to go to the hospital one night, and my mother had to go with him on some level. And I'm like 7 years old and my brother Scott is 5. So she said, look, this is, and she still stresses about this. She says, I got to go to this. I'll be right back. And me being rusty, I'm like, fine, you know, go ahead. You know, so my brother and I watched A Night to Remember, which is one of the original Titanic movies. So to this day, I still have a difficulty watching ship sink. So it's funny how these things kind of get into us, you know. And so, you know, why did you leave a law practice to do this?
Well, you talk about, things that happen at a young age impacting our lives. When I was 6, my dad died, and it just, I mean, maybe obviously like sent me into a tailspin. And sure. I think parents are like doing the best they can with what they have. I've really, at least mine, I firmly believe that about her. But there are things that I wish that I had, like maybe therapy or some right. other support at that time. And, you know, not having the language for what I was experiencing then made things really challenging, but it caused a lot of dissociation, anxiety, perfectionism, depression, led into panic attacks. And so basically my whole life from like 6 to, I guess, 27, I felt like I needed to do something in order mm-hmm. to be loved. And my something was like being smart and getting good sure. grades and achieving yeah. academically. But that yeah. didn't like actually give me anything personally. And it didn't make me happy, that's for sure. So I was a deeply unhappy lawyer. Actually, I don't know a lot of happy lawyers, but I was definitely
I don't know either. You know, it's my best friend of like almost 50 years now, he's a lawyer. Like when we were teenagers together, we both worked at this restaurant in Victoria called the Princess Mary. We didn't like each other when we first met, and then we became friends and that kind of thing. And he went into a law and I went into medicine. He actually really enjoys being a trial lawyer because he's a little bit confrontational to start with. So he really enjoyed that field. And for me with medicine, I just got really tired of treating symptoms as opposed to getting at the root cause. So that's really what it came down to. So, but I know what you mean about, you know, happy lawyers. Like it's an adversarial field. So if you're sort of got this connective personality, it's difficult to be in a field where you're, you know, day to day fighting all the time. You know, you really have to have a special kind of personality that doesn't really affect you emotionally.
It's very adversarial. Like even the process of going to law school, you're yeah. competing and wanting other people to fail so that you can do better. And I've really found like over the years that I feel if we as a society were raising humans that, you know, hurt people, I really believe sure. that, right? If we yeah. experience less hurt, we wouldn't need as much legal recourse. The law is really like it's like a symptom, right? But we're not getting to the root cause of like, why are people doing this to other people? Why are people behaving this way?
Yeah, I firmly believe that you have your nervous system is built on either connection or protection. And that gets formed when you're very young. So if you have trauma when you're younger, so my little acronym is ALARMS. So abuse, loss, major loss, like loss of your dad, abandonment, which stands for kind of easy to understand, rejection, which is like bullying, neglect, that kind of thing. And the M is for mature too early, anything that made you mature too early. For boys, it's becoming the man of the family. Dad's an alcoholic. For girls, it's often having sex too early, you know, which there's so much shame. And that's what leads into the last one. Like shame is the alarms, the S on the alarms. And anything that shames you as a child will build this alarm in your system. And that alarm in your system is actually what generates the anxiety of your mind. Your mind is really, your brain is just really a reflector of what's going on in your body. I mean, there is some self-generated stuff from your brain, but we're a lot more reactive than we are reflective or responsive. We like to think that we have free will, but I think a lot of us are pre-programmed in a certain way. And if your nervous system is programmed towards protection, it's highly energy inefficient and you'll be tired. You'll have a lot of things. And I think that's why we burn out in professions and that kind of thing too. Because if your nervous system is always looking for how to protect itself, it takes a lot of energy to protect yourself all the time. So I imagine like losing your dad at 6 years old, your nervous system is going to get forged in that sort of protective way.
Yeah, I really can see the ways that I was seeking to control as a child. Like my mom thought it was so weird that I brought a planner to Disney World at like age 8. But in my mind, if I could, or I would have schedules of how I would play with my toys. And I thought if I didn't play with each one enough, they would like not feel loved.
Okay.
Because I was constant. My dad was someone who I felt loved me unconditionally. And I know my mom now loves me unconditionally and did then. It was harder for me to see it at that age though.
Yeah. I mean, I think we do, you know, have different. Like my dad was the one who was loving and caring. Not that my mother wasn't, but my mother was a Scottish nurse. So she got raised in this family where you weren't hugged. You weren't told you were loved. You know, it's like you had a roof over your head and you had food. So that was, that's how you were expected to just know you were loved. So yeah, so I lost my dad probably around, I would say 12, 13. Like he lived until I was 26, but his mental illness kind of took him away at that point. So you have this sort of loving, caring parent, and then you lose that loving, caring parent. And then the other parent is not quite as loving or caring. My mom had to sort of support the family. So that I think really forged a lot of my own nervous system in this sort of protective and then performative too. You know, there's part of me that really loves being seen and loves doing this work and writing books and stuff. And there's part of me that just hates it. Just hates being, you know, observed and that kind of thing too. So I don't know how that sort of ranges for you. Becoming a lawyer is a pretty big deal.
It is. And I truly am so happy that I went to law school. I'm sure you had experiences in medical school that felt similar, but it just changed the way I thought, where I was just like, wow, I'm never going to get this kind of like mental stimulation or prompt in the same way. It's never a bad thing to have in your back pocket and understanding the law, especially like nowadays and about constitutional issues and me thinking like, that's not quite it. Mm-hmm. Nice try. So it was difficult and it also wasn't difficult at a certain point because I got to like a critical juncture where I could just not hold the anxiety in my body anymore. And I knew something had to shift or I was going to like not just have a panic attack, have like a full blown nervous breakdown.
So what shifted, Julie? What got you to sort of say, no, I can't do this anymore?
Well, the last year of law school was really hard for me. I ended a relationship and that's what actually prompted me to go to therapy for the first time and read the book Codependent No More. And
Melanie Beattie, yeah.
Wow. Like
book. Yeah.
I'm codependent. You know, I recommend it to people all the time. So I'm now thinking about, I'm learning more about high functioning codependency. And doing that was beautiful. And I don't want to say this about all therapists, but I found my therapist, it felt kind of re-traumatizing week after week. Like your dad died and then your mom didn't raise you right. And that's why you are the way you are. And I'm like, thanks lady. I could have told you that, but how can I move forward? It felt very backward focused. And so I did it. I got to a certain point. I'd also used pharmaceuticals, Prozac, and I didn't feel as intensely sad, but I also didn't really feel anything. Yeah. I kind of reached a zombie point and I was like, well, I also don't want this.
Yep.
And then I hired a coach my first or second year practicing as an attorney. And that I loved. I was like, wow, like this is future oriented. And it's getting to, we're focusing on me versus constantly focusing on like past and what other people have done. Right. And I just found it way more useful and supportive. And that's really what unlocked everything and made me think, this is work that I love. It's so supportive. And I want to do this, I think. So that's where it really jumped off.
So how did you officially sort of end your law career? I'm interested because, you know, when I left medicine, it was kind of traumatic. I ruptured my left Achilles tendon and it was kind of, and spiritually, you know, your Achilles tendon is moving forward. So if I'm not moving forward anymore, which I wasn't with medicine, I was kind of stuck in the same place. If you're not moving forward anymore, there is this kind of angst that builds in you. And if you have a tendency towards anxiety, it just gets worse and worse and worse. So how was it? Did you do it sort of gradually? Like it's hard to leave a profession that provides you with a pretty good income to go and do this work.
You know, mine was quite dramatic as well. I always believe like the universe is sort of like a river attempting to route us toward like our highest path or the mm-hmm. path of least resistance. And you can either sort of submit to that flow and be in tune with it, or you can really fight and be the salmon. I was attempting to be the salmon. I had decided I was going to move to California and start practicing in a new practice area in special education. I thought that would be more fulfilling for me. So I was working with an East Coast firm that was going to open its West Coast office. I took the California bar in February 2020. And by March 2020, the pandemic had hit. My law office wasn't opening its office during the pandemic. And I was like, I'm in California. I have my California admission. What am I doing? And what am I doing became coaching.
Okay. And what were your early experiences like with that? Did it sort of like, this is what I want to do?
I always felt like it was what I wanted to do. I love my coaching certification. It was beautiful. Life coaching, NLP certification, something I still use, but it wasn't anything to do with psychedelics at that mm-hmm. point. But I was very into it. I felt like this was something I was naturally good at. Building a business and being good at your craft are two very different things. So building mm-hmm. a business was challenging, but I always loved the craft and felt very much like it was what I was meant to be doing.
So how did it look? What did you start with?
Like witchy stuff. So different. Like okay. I love tarot. I love reading what Carl Jung has to like think and say about tarot and how it can, you know, illuminate things in our subconscious and how it reflects themes that every human being goes through in different archetypes. Then I went into like very opposite. I thought, okay, wait, I'm not utilizing this lawyer thing. So I'll do corporate, like CEO, executive coaching. And I liked that. I thought I was having conversations I still really enjoyed. But something felt off. And then I found psychedelics and psychedelic facilitation. And I was just like, this is it. And it's been 4 years now.
What was the first psychedelic you did?
LSD.
Okay.
LSD,
me too.
More recreationally, yeah. not in a guided way, but I was older. I was about 27, so okay. I loved it.
Okay. Well, I didn't like mine very much, my LSD experience, but it did. My LSD experience, I read about this in my book, about that it really showed me that my anxiety, what I was calling my anxiety, was actually the state of alarm that was stuck in my body, in my solar plexus. And then people listening to the podcast will know it. Like it's a fist shaped hot purple crystalline structure that pushes into my spine and into my heart. So that's what it showed me. And then from that point on, I thought, okay, well, what's this somatic piece? What's this piece in the body that creates this alarm? And then it developed into this sort of alarm anxiety cycle theory, where the anxiety in your mind is really just this alarm in your body, and your brain is reading that. It's reading that alarm and it's making sense because your brain is a meaning-making, make-sense machine. So what it does, it reads that alarm. It feeds it feeds this negative projection of the future, because if your future was impaired when you were younger, as for me, it was like when my dad would go crazy and then he'd be fine for 12 months and he'd go crazy again. So there is this sense that I predicted through worry, and worry actually created this sort of dopaminergic structure sense in my brain that, okay, you're on the right track. You're predicting something that could happen. But unfortunately, that's how worry becomes addictive. So we go into this place where we always have to predict the future And most of the time it's wrong. And we just go, oh, well, just it was wrong. I didn't really follow that. But it's really understanding that anxiety at its core is this sense of alarm. That's what LSD showed me. And then from that point, taking the somatic approach to it, I got really to the root cause of what was causing the anxiety, as opposed to just what you were saying, you know, dealing with the day-to-day elements of it. Yeah, my dad died. Yeah, my mom didn't quite have the same connection with me. You know, you can repeat that over and over. And I think there is this fallacy that if you understand what happened to you as a child, it will automatically just sort of rejig itself like a jigsaw puzzle. And it doesn't. And in fact, it can be re-traumatizing, like you said. And what, you know, psilocybin, LSD, ayahuasca, peyote, these things, is they separate the parts of your brain that think from the parts of your brain that feel. So, you know, it blurs the line between conscious and unconscious. So you have all these like weird hallucination kind of things. And then it also blurs the line between self and other. So you feel one with everything. So I think that's, you know, the way of the future is to try and go into these places rather than dealing with like Prozac and that kind of thing, which just basically throws a blanket over the symptoms.
Definitely throws a blanket, leaves you feeling numb. I know a lot of people have had the zombie effect.
Yeah, sure.
Can I ask you a question?
Mm-hmm.
So I was munching on anxiety yesterday during my walk and really thinking about it, because I think my hallmark like symptom was apocalyptic thinking. It was constantly worst case scenario. This is what's going to happen. Through psychedelics, I sometimes still experience anxiety, but anxiety anxious isn't a word I would use to describe myself. Mm-hmm. I was sort of parsing like, what is anxiety? And what stuck out to me is you said your experience allowed you to see this crystalline structure like in your solar plexus. And when I sort of got to like my end of the mental pathway, I sort of landed on self-trust and like solar plexus feeling, you know, willpower, self-determination. I kind of see those things as like overlapping. And I guess my end thought was thinking like, oh, anxiety is the worry that whatever you encounter, you won't be able to handle because there's some part of you that you don't trust to fully execute. And I'm kind of wondering how that showed up for you.
Well, I think what happens is that, you know, we get this norepinephrine in our brain, epinephrine and cortisol in our body, and it sets off this cascade of fight or flight in our body. Now that shuts off a lot of our rational prefrontal cortex. So the brain, being a meaning making make sense machine, when it feels that alarm in the body, when it feels that fight or flight response in the body, it creates a story to match it. So it creates all these worries. And then on top of that, like I said, we paralyze the part of our brain that would see that these worries are kind of irrational and not likely to happen. So we get double whammied. We get hit with the fact that we can't assess our worries for valid truth, and we make more of the worries. So of course that compounds the fight or flight reflex in your body. So you get what's called, I call it the anxiety alarm cycle, or the alarm anxiety cycle. And then you get trapped in that, because anxiety, the way I see it, is not one entity, but two. It's this alarm that's in the body that nobody ever looks for because it's not part of traditional therapy. And the anxious thoughts of the mind. The anxious thoughts of the mind are like the tip of the iceberg. We can see the anxious thoughts quite clearly, but the part below it, the alarm that's in the body, we don't pay any attention to at all, or we don't even actually look for it. And it's a shame, because that's what's causing most of the problem. So we wind up doing CBT and all these sort of cognitive therapies to try and change the top one-ninth, the part that we can see, when really the true underlying cause is this alarm from usually old unresolved childhood wounding that's creating the top part of the iceberg. So we try and chop off the top part of the iceberg, and then it just pops up again. So we're really not doing anything like long term when we just treat people with cognitive therapy.
Yeah.
I don't know if that answers your question.
No. That was definitely part of my experience as well. And like that feeling, anyone who's ever experienced anxiety knows it, where you just, it is, right? Your prefrontal cortex is turning off and it feels like you have lost control of the ship. You're not steering your ship. Your body is just like away from you. And then it's incapacitating in some ways. It feels like you can't do anything else but be in the anxiety of whatever it is that's causing this alarm in your body. One of the best things I ever heard from someone after leading them through like a larger experience, she suffered from really intense, like fibromyalgia pain. And she was like, that whole trip, I did not have any pain. And I had actually forgot what it was like to exist in a body without pain. And that was so like jarring, but also profound to me.
Yeah. Well, a lot of things in medicine, like fibromyalgia, irritable bowel syndrome, we do biopsies of the muscles in fibromyalgia, can't find anything. We do biopsies of the bowel in irritable, but even severe irritable bowel syndrome, don't find anything. So a lot of it is this, there's a huge mental component to that. And there's a part of our brain called the insula. And the insula kind of coordinates sort of the mind to the body in a lot of the ways. So the back part of the insula handles physical pain and the front part of the insula handles emotional pain. And this is why when we have emotional pain, physical pain feels so much worse. And when we have physical pain, why emotional pain feels so much worse. But this insular cortex, I believe, is going to be a huge player in therapy in the future because it really maps the body. And I think what happens is this. We get a trauma that's too much for us to bear. We lose our dad when we're 6 years old. It's not repaired. So the people around us don't have the capacity to repair it. So it gets pushed down from the conscious mind into the unconscious mind. And because the body is a representation of the unconscious mind, it gets stuffed down, sort of sequestered away in the body. And we never look for it again. And then we try and fix the thoughts that are surrounding the whole issue and never get to the root cause of the problem. So no one gets better from anxiety, OCD, this kind of stuff, because we're not really dealing with the root cause of the problem. We're dealing with the symptoms. So it's learning that we have to deal with the underlying cause, which I believe is this alarm that's held in our body. And I think what psychedelics do is they paralyze something called the default mode network. And the default mode network in the brain creates this kind of continuous sense of self, right? So this is who I am. I'm an anxious person. I'm worthless. Everything I do turns to crap, you know, all this kind of stuff. It's in this default mode. So what psychedelics do is they shut off the default mode. So you get to see yourself for who you are without all this crap that got put into you when you were younger. And then when you're able to see that, when you're able to see the other side, you know, it's possible. You know, it's possible to make it there. And I think once you see that other side, you can sort of embody that, and it's something that cognitive therapy is never going to get you to.
Yeah, the DMN is actually my favorite thing to talk about.
Okay, let's go for it.
The thing that I like to connect it to this Harvard research study in the psychology of happiness, where they looked at all these different factors that would contribute to someone's happiness, right? Whether it be money, like physical attractiveness, et cetera. And what they found was happiness was really tied to presence. How often are you in the present moment? And that 48% of your day, or like, I think that was the numbers. People generally aren't present. They're in their DMN. They're either thinking like crappy thoughts about themselves, or they're replaying a scenario in the past, thinking about worst case scenarios in the future. So when we can shut off blood flow, when we look at those fMRI scans that do show that blood flow is decreased to the DMN, when people are using psychedelics, it's like you have this chance to just be without the like encumberment of your mind.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a part of our DMN called the posterior cingulate cortex. So DMN is posterior cingulate, angular gyrus, precuneus, and medial prefrontal cortex. Those are the main, there's sub parts of the DMN, but those are the main ones. So the medial prefrontal cortex is the part of us that kind of has rational, semi-rational control over who we are, who we believe we are. But the posterior cingulate cortex is thought to be kind of the home of self-referential, particularly negative self-referential thinking. So that negative self-referential thinking in the default mode network. So the default mode network, for people that haven't listened to this before, is this place that we go to in our brains when we're not actively doing a task. So there's the task performative network, and then there's the default mode network. So when we're actively doing something, we're in the task positive network. The other part of that is the DMN. So we go into this DMN hundreds of times a day. Now, if that DMN in the posterior cingulate has this thing, I'm not worthwhile. Nothing I do works. I'm too skinny, too fat, whatever it is. It will just keep replaying unconsciously in your mind over and over and over again. And that, of course, will create more alarm in your system. And the more alarm you create in the system, the more you shut off the default mode network, or turn on the default mode network, because you don't want to deal with it. And it sort of takes your life over. it sort of becomes this weight that you drag around with you. So this is why presence. So when you go into present moment sensation and you make this cognitive decision, I'm going into the present moment, you get into the task positive network, and the task positive network shuts off the default mode network, and you're actually present in the present moment. Now, trauma makes it uncomfortable to stay in the present moment a lot of the time, because when we stop, and this is why meditators with trauma have such a hard time, when you stop, that's when the trauma will come up. When you become quiet, that's when the trauma comes up. And then the default mode network will shut on as a way of protecting you. But it's not protecting you because it's replaying all this this crap over and over and over again. So when we bring in sort of the hippocampus to this, the hippocampus kind of modifies our emotional memories. So when we're making active memories, it shuts off the default mode network, the hippocampus. But when we're stuck in self-referential negative thinking, the hippocampus and the default mode network kind of work together in this very negative way of going, oh, remember when you did that? Remember when you did that? You know, so it's really interesting to see what turns off the default mode network. Commonly, it's present moment awareness. So even things like tapping, you know, even that anything that brings you into present moment sensation will tend to turn off that default mode network. But the problem is it's still there. It's still in the background running. So what we have to do to treat this, in my opinion, is to get into that default mode network, allow people to be in it, and then acclimatize to that negative feeling and that negative emotion that goes along with the default mode network. So we acclimatize to it, so it immediately doesn't take us over. And we go, oh, I know this is coming. I know this is going to start saying, you know, you're this or you're that, or you're never going to account. I know this is going to happen. So I can just sit back and smile and observe it. It's like the Michael Singer quote that says, you are not your thoughts. You are the observer of your thoughts. Anyway, I went on a bit of a rant there.
No, I love it. I'm really into the science behind all of this. I like especially what you said at the end. It made me think of a quote that I'm not going to quote directly from Eckhart Tolle.
Yep.
Okay. I always get his name wrong. Thinking in a new earth that we are not unhappy because of the feelings that we're experiencing, but rather the unhappy story that we attach to them. So having the ability to sit with the feeling and know that it's not going to swallow you like the ocean, that you can hold whatever it is, wherever it lies in your body, and that it is not the truth of the story, I find to be really, really powerful and supportive and healing.
But as a child, it did swallow you like the ocean because you didn't have agency. You couldn't move out of the house. You couldn't do anything. So when you were a child, it did that feeling did feel completely overwhelming. And because the amygdala in our brains has no sense of time, when we go into these anxious phases, a lot of them is an age regression. So we'll go back to the six-year-old who lost her dad. We'll go back to the eight-year-old who was walking home from school and didn't know if mom was going to be drunk. We go back into that place with all the wherewithal of an eight-year-old, which isn't a lot, but then we believe that we're adults, but we're not. It's like when you get into a fight with your partner, and this is what I do with Cynthia, my wife, it's like we have these pictures of each other when we're 9 years old. Because when we're having a fight, when we're having an argument about something, I'll go and look at that picture of her, and it's like, that's who I'm arguing with. I'm arguing with the nine-year-old version of her, and she's arguing with the nine-year-old version of me. And almost immediately, it discharges a lot of that energy. So it's a lot of it is just the memories that we hold in the hippocampus and other parts of our brain that sort of just reignite when we feel this negative pull to our past. And it just takes us away from the present moment that we're in, because the only change we can make is in this present moment. But again, the present moment can be really uncomfortable, especially if you have trauma, because it'll keep bubbling up to the surface until you deal with it. Once you deal with it and you see, I can get around this, I can actually see the backside of this trauma, this pain, I can see that I am adult and an adult now. I'm not the child that I was before. I can actually feel this. Even though it's uncomfortable, I can stay with it. And the kind of the analogy that I draw is cold plunges. I don't know if you've ever done cold plunges
before. I'm a big fan of cold plunges. Actually.
So basically what I think we're doing with cold plunges is we're staying with the alarm in our body. That's the metaphor. So I tell people, look, we've got to find this alarm. In me, it's in my solar plexus. Some people it's in their throat. Some people it's in their heart. Usually it's in the midline of the body somewhere. So we have to learn how to stay with this uncomfortable emotion and just put our hand over it and just breathe into it and learn how to stay with it. Which is kind of what cold plunges do. Like when you go in a cold plunge, it's as soon as you walk in there, everything in your body says, get the hell out of here. Like just leave it, which is basically what happens when we're anxious, is that there's an alarm in our body. We don't want to deal with that alarm in our body. So what we do is we go up into our head and we dissociate into our thoughts, into our worries, because it gives us a temporary respite from that pain of alarm. But if every time we feel that pain of alarm, or we're not aware of it, but we feel it, we go into our heads, we never process it. So we're always afraid of it. So every time it comes up, we will immediately go into worries, because that's was our coping strategy as a child. And we just keep going with that same coping strategy. So it's learning how to be able to feel that. And I think that's where psychedelics kind of come in, is they show us, okay, here it is on some level. This is what it feels like. But you are so much more expansive than this small amount of pain that you're holding in your body. And once you see that, you can start seeing that it isn't the giant, this indomitable giant as it was as a child. And then when you have that, you can allow yourself to stay with it, so you don't immediately have to shoot into your head to escape into worry. And then you break what I call the alarm anxiety cycle. And when you break the cycle, you start to heal. Anything other than that is basically just learning how to cope, which is what a lot of cognitive therapies are. I sound really negative against it. I think we need cognitive therapy for sure, but we need body therapy, somatic therapy, an understanding of what's going on with the alarm in our system more than that.
I like to say that I know a lot of people notice this specifically in microdosing and going about your day, that there creates like a bubble of sort of safety, yeah, or response, so that you can acknowledge the uncomfortable feeling and, mm-hmm, you could even like interact with it, but you don't have to be consumed by it or fully like hugging it. Yep. And in that space, you have more opportunity to deal with it effectively.
Yeah. The way I say it is, when you see it, you don't have to be it. And I think that's exactly kind of what happens with psychedelics, is you can see, oh, I have some distance. I have some separation, a degree of separation from this, because typically I don't. When I'm in it, it does take me over. I do turn into a 5-year-old on some level. So when you see it, it's like, oh, this is actually not me. This is just a part of me that is crying for my attention, because I do believe that that alarm in our system is the younger version of yourself. And we can use that sense of alarm as a portal in time to go back and find that child and give them the repair now that they so badly needed back then.
I also found that in my own work, just on myself and, you know, using psychedelics, experiencing things like IFS, I've gotten to a point where like, I used to think that she needed to go away. She being like this, mm-hmm, little 6-year-old at the hospital, like just found out her dad died. And now I've gotten to the point where I know that she's there and I don't need her to be different. And like you brought up, you know, your wife. And I do think like romantic partnerships are oftentimes some of the hardest and most like challenging and triggering,
oh yeah,
interactions that we have. And for me, it definitely, she is the loudest when she feels like she may potentially be abandoned by a male. Oh, I'm right. Straight, but yeah, like thinking in that way.
And that makes perfect sense, right? Because you were abandoned by a male.
Yeah.
So that is going to be a very tender spot for you. So it's learning where do you feel that in your body? Like when you bring up, you know, being told, you know, going to that hospital, being told that your dad has died, where does that come up in your system? And can you come alongside that little 6-year-old girl? There's all these things out there about, you know, anxiety warrior and fight your anxiety. Your anxiety is the child part of you. Why are you fighting the child part of you? Right? It makes no sense to me. Like whenever I see that, I go, ah, no, that's just not going to work. Right? So it's understanding that alarm is the younger version of you. It's a portal. And thank God that the sensation is that intense, because it becomes this portal that you can use to actually soothe and resolve that alarm, because it is the younger version of you asking for the repair that it didn't get.
And being able to, I love that you said the cold plunge example. Mm-hmm. I had knee surgery in April, and I've been doing this work for, we'll say, 6 years. But after having knee surgery, I started using cold plunges as a way to improve my physical health. Right. And from the cold plunges, I have noticed the greatest amount of like ability to sit with and not necessarily go to my old behaviors of needing to repair instantly or flooding my body, unable, like just ruminating and looping in my head. So Cole, I think, you know, the sitting in session is valuable. It's needed. And so many people miss out on the physical ways that we can train our body, accustom our body to be okay in the discomfort.
And that's what I'm talking about, the anterior insula, right? So the insula is really the somatic reference in the brain. So the insula maps the body. It maps pain onto the body. So when we get a breakup, when we have heart pain, the insula is actually mapping that pain onto the heart area. That's why it feels like a physical pain. So what you're doing when you do cold plunges is you're showing, this is really uncomfortable, but I can stay with it. And that's really, so a lot of pain is the resistance to pain. David Hawkins has this book called Letting Go. I think it's in Letting Go, where he talks about cutting his thumb with a bandsaw, and he's allergic to anesthetics. So he just has to sit there with the pain. And he said, when I resisted the pain, it became unbearable. But when I just allowed the pain to be there, it was considerably easier. So much of our troubles is our own inability to just stay with it. Now, as a child, you had no choice but to stay with it. So it became this abhorrent kind of thing. I don't want to stay with this pain because there's no way out. Now, as an adult, there is a way out. You start realizing, oh, okay, I am in charge of this. I am in charge of how long I will stay in the cold water. You know, and there's points where I go, no, I can't do it. I get out. But there's also points where I go, no, just another 15 seconds, just another 15 seconds. And then you do the 15 seconds, like, no, I could do another 15. And you just keep going. And I think what you're doing is you're teaching that insula, we can handle this pain. We don't need to go into default. We don't need to go into this sort of, I need to get away from this right away. And getting away from it usually winds up going into your head and overthinking and worrying. And that basically pushes the problem to an area where it doesn't exist. So, and then we start trying to treat the worries when the worries are just a byproduct of the alarm. The alarm is the root cause. The worries are the byproduct. So when we're trying to treat the worries in cognitive therapy, we're treating the symptom as opposed to the root cause. So we never actually get to the end of it. We never, and this is one of the reasons I left medicine, is because we never actually went after the root cause, especially in things like fibromyalgia and irritable bowel, when I knew it was psychologically motivated. I'm not saying it's not real. Alan Gordon has this talk about neuroplastic pain, about how we teach ourselves to have pain. And the insula, I think, has a huge amount to do with that. So learning how to handle adversity and stay with it basically just transforms your life.
I also think we spend a lot of time in most therapies thinking about, I kind of obsessing over why, and I actually find why to be the least useful question.
Yep.
Because I don't know that we'll ever fully know why, right? There are so many factors that play into even what I'm saying right now and our interaction that are below, like 98% of it is unconscious, right? Like, yeah. Why focus and perseverate on the why when we could instead get into the body, get into the somatics and hold whatever is without needing to dissect it and explain it away?
Yeah. Well, there is, you know, in the brain, blame is rewarded in the blame. When we blame something else, there's through the BTA and the nucleus accumbens, we get a dopamine rush from blaming someone else. So the worst thing for human beings is when we hear about murder, well, maybe not the worst, but one of them, is we hear about murder-suicide, because there is nothing to blame at that point. There's no one to hold accountable. And that's a very uncomfortable circuit. And I think self-blame is the same thing. It's a very uncomfortable circuit because you push the blame away, but you're blaming yourself. So it just boomerangs. So you put yourself in this sort of distracted, dissociated position of self-blame because it takes you away from that immediate sensation of alarm. But again, you're just bypassing the root cause of the problem.
Would you say that that's why like so much of society is obsessed with like true crime and finding out who done it? Like, is there some sort of like thing?
There's definitely a dopamine rush when there's something that causes us a lot of angst and a lot of pain. And then there's something that we can use to sort of alleviate that pain, sort of holding somebody accountable for what's going on. And I think that's what's happening in the political system right now is as the U.S. kind of collapses and, you know, economically and culturally and socially, they're looking for someone to blame. And then when they blame someone, there's no attribution of it. There's no acceptance of it. There's no completion. So it just keeps going and it keeps going and keeps going, which causes more and more and more alarm with people. And then they become more and more irrational. So if you are on one side, you will double down on your beliefs. And if you're on the other side, you'll double down on your beliefs. And then both sides just become more and more divided from each other as it goes by. So it's a very interesting perspective to watch the United States from a neuroscientific point of view right now.
Yeah, it's interesting too. I oftentimes find that, especially after like a larger journey, I work with women. So mm-hmm. the women will oftentimes say like they can find more like acceptance and goodwill overall versus needing to, because we see the interconnectedness of all, right? We experience right. it in our body. And like you said, like ego dissolution, oftentimes that can result in us not feeling like identified with a body and feeling a bit more amorphous and less solid and our boundaries like physically. And that can result in feelings that I think help bridge a gap that we experience so much in current day United States.
Yeah. And I think it's true with women too, like the angst that comes up with women, because you look at divorce statistics, you know, 80% of divorces are initiated by the woman, right? And it is one of those things that I think women have this, I think they're just more prone to find the problems with things. Whereas with men, we have problems, but we stuff them down. So it just, and you get this avoidant, you know, this whole dance that men and women do where, you know, the woman says, we need this fixed, and the man just avoids it, right? And then eventually she has to do something. So it's very interesting to see how we interact with each other, male, female as well. And just the differences in, you know, the neurochemistry. There's more, Shelley Taylor, she's a PhD. She did some work in stress in women, and stress in women shoot up their oxytocin, whereas stress in men doesn't shoot up oxytocin. So women have this feeling like they're really stressed, but they so badly want to connect to something, whereas men don't have that, which is maybe one of the reasons why women are more likely to stay in abusive relationships, because the stress comes up, but the need to connect also comes up too. So they're kind of caught with their own sort of neurochemistry in a way that wouldn't allow them to kind of separate from that, which maybe is because, you know, when your kids are being jerks at, you know, 4 or 5, you know, you have to be able to stick it, hang in there and love them and go, okay, we'll do this. You know, whereas the man kind of goes, I'm out of here. I can't deal with this. So unfair to women for sure. But I think maybe that's the biochemical reason why oxytocin comes up with women, because they get so stressed by the children that they want to leave them, but they can't. They can't.
They just cannot.
Yeah. So it's part of it for sure. Is there anything we haven't touched on? I know we didn't touch a lot on psychedelics, but what do you think the biggest benefit is to using psychedelics in practice?
Well, I'd say I bring it back to this idea of moms. I would say I'm not a mother. I don't necessarily market towards mothers, but over 50% of the people that I work with are moms. And I think that the biggest benefit is that bubble that we briefly touched on, this, mm-hmm. this space. What did you say? You don't have to be it? You can see it.
Yeah, if you can see it, you don't have to be it, right? So that's just, you know, getting a degree of separation from it.
Yeah, and I think that it sounds so like simple, but when you never have it and you're constantly forced into just experiencing the intensity of it all the time, whatever it is, right? Frustration, anger, overwhelm, that space is life-changing.
Mm-hmm. It's a whole new world. Mm-hmm. When you see that you don't, this isn't you. Like this whole sensation, this alarm, this feeling of overwhelming anxiety and, you know, overwhelming dread, it's not who you are. It's you've learned, your brain has learned through this protective mechanism to teach you, and you've seen it day after day after day after day. And the default mode network, I think, plays a role in this, is it has a continuous sense of self. I think the default mode network, the more you worry, the more you likely are to see yourself as a worrier. And you just replicate that pattern over and over again. And I think when you see that that pattern isn't who you truly are, you have a little exit, you have a little off ramp that you can take. Now, some people don't take it the first, you know, 2 or 3 times, but after you've seen it a number of times, you kind of go, do I really want to live my life this way? Even though it's familiar, and human beings equate familiarity with security. So it's hard for us to leave even something that's painful, you know, and something like worry was a coping strategy as a child. you know, you have this alarm that's stuck in your body and you go in your head and you start worrying and dissociating, that becomes a coping strategy. So we start using that all the way into adulthood. So when we get stressed, we move automatically into worry. Default mode network says you're a worrier. So it just becomes this self-fulfilling prophecy for the rest of your life until you see it and you don't have to be it. And I think one of the benefits of psychedelics is it gives you that bubble. It gives you that sort of degree. Like once you see the other side, you kind of go, oh, and MDMA did that for me. It sort of showed me, hey, you know, I am a really loving person towards myself. I just don't experience that on a daily basis. So once you see another way, you can kind of start following that path a little more. But if that path's never shown to you, if you never see that path ever in your life, you don't know it's there.
Yeah. And I think that we get to change the way that we talk about these things, right? Because so many people are like, oh, just choose a better thought, or it couldn't be that hard. It change is hard. Change is really difficult. And as you said, like if you've never seen it, how can you know that it's available to you?
And that's, I think that's true. It's like at points that I talk to people who are suicidal. And at one point after I ruptured my Achilles and left medicine and stuff, I sort of danced with that a little bit. And you look right and that's abhorrent. You look left, that's abhorrent. There's just no place that isn't excruciatingly painful. So people don't want to die. They just want to end the pain. Mm-hmm. And I think what I usually say to people who I talk to who are kind of dancing with that, it's like there is a way out. It's just you can't see it. It's just not, you can't see it right now. And it's just like, keep going, like just keep going. And you know, luckily most people do keep going and they do find a way out. But I do think that psychedelics and somatic work and IFS and these sort of things allow us a different picture. They allow us to see things in maybe a more compartmentalized way that allows us to sort of separate from it. You know, this isn't all of me. Whereas when you were a child, it was all of you.
Yeah, it's a beautiful opportunity, right? Like you don't know what you're missing if you've never seen it.
Yeah.
I was just talking with a client who said her mom didn't have a bank account, so they paid everything by money order. So as an adult, she didn't realize like you needed to go get a bank account, which for most people is just sort of this thing that they're so familiarized with.
Right.
But if you've never seen it, you don't know that it's there for you. You don't know to do it.
Yeah, that's a good point. You know, so how do people find you, Julie?
Well, you can find me over on Instagram. It's just my name, Julie Savone. So go pop in. I'm very friendly, happy to chat, answer any questions, or on my website. It's the same as my name, juliesavone.com.
And is there anything you'd like to leave us with as far as, you know, how psychedelics have helped you and you know, how it allow you to make the transition from, you know, lawyer to, you know, someone who helps other people? Not that lawyers don't, but, you know what I'm saying.
You know, I think one of the biggest benefits of psychedelics is, or at least the way that I facilitate and was taught to facilitate, is the use of intention, of having a really clear intention of what you're looking to get out of the experience overall, but just even in your day. And so even if microdosing or having a larger ceremonial experience isn't something that you're interested in, infusing that intentional aspect, I find to be super powerful. And then just a reminder that these are powerful tools and they do give you the opportunity to seize, for instance, the bubble or the off ramp.
Mm.
And that practice of integration is what's really going to allow those experiences to change your life, because it's not about taking the off-ramp once. It's
right.
about continuing to choose the off-ramp, even when your partner is triggering your little 5-year-old self and you just want to yell at them. That is the time to explore the off-ramp and come back to it.
Sounds great, Julie. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.